Are you asking? It's not like you to ask idle questions.
There's obviously an entire unexplored world down here, Nicole replied. It would take a lifetime.
We don't have that long, Richard broke in with a laugh. At least, not a normal lifetime. But back to your thickness question. Remember, the entire southern hemicylinder has a floor level 450 meters above the north. So, unless there are some major structural irregularities, and we certainly haven't seen any from the outside, the thickness should be substantially greater than the south. Richard waited for Nicole to say something additional. When she remained silent for several seconds, he turned back to the monitor and continued his surrogate exploration with the robots. There had been a good reason for Nicole's question about the thickness of the shell. She had a picture in her mind that she could not shake. Nicole was imagining coming out of the end of one of these long underground tunnels, opening a door, and then being blinded by the light of the sun. Wouldn't it be incredible, she was thinking, to be an intelligent creature living in this maze of dim lights and tunnels, and then, by chance, to stumble onto something that would irrevocably change your entire concept of the universe? How could you return? Now what in the world is that? Richard was asking. Nicole stopped her mental drifting and focused on the monitor. Prince Hal and Falstaff had entered a large room at the opposite end of the subway station and were standing in front of a conglomeration of loose, sponge-like webbing. The infrared image of the scene showed a nested sphere inside the web that was radiating heat. At Nicole's suggestion, Richard commanded the robots to walk around the object and survey the rest of this new domain. The room was immense. It extended into the distance further than the resolution of the video devices carried by the robots. The ceiling was about 20 meters high, and the two side walls were separated by more than 50 meters. Several other similar spherical objects, encased in spongy masses, could be seen scattered about the room in the distance. A lattice, stretching almost all the way across the room but stopping 5 meters above the floor, dangled from the high ceiling in the foreground. Another lattice could barely be discerned 100 meters or so behind the first one. Richard and Nicole discussed what the robots should do next. There were no other exits from either the subway station or the large room. A panoramic image around the room revealed nothing nearby of interest, except the sphere, embedded in its spongy exterior. Nicole wanted to bring the robots back and leave the lair altogether. Richard's curiosity demanded at least a cursory investigation of one of the spherical objects. The two robots were able, with some difficulty, to climb around and through the webbed material to reach the sphere in the center. The ambient temperature increased as they neared the sphere. One of the purposes of the external material was clearly to absorb heat. When the robots reached the nested sphere, their internal monitors flashed a warning that the outside temperatures exceeded their safe operating limits. Richard moved quickly, directing the robots on a nearly continuous basis. He determined that the sphere was virtually impenetrable and was probably made of a thick metal alloy with a very hard surface. Falstaff banged on the sphere several times with his arm. The resulting sound damped quickly, indicating the sphere was full, possibly with a liquid. The two robots were weaving their way out of the sponge webbing when their audio systems picked up the sound of brushes dragging against metal. Richard tried to speed up their escape. Hal was able to increase his pace, but Falstaff, whose subsystem temperatures had risen too high during his proximity to the sphere, was prevented by his own internal processor logic from accelerating his actions. The brush sound continued to grow louder. The computer monitor on the ledge between the two cosmonauts was changed to split screen. Prince Hal reached the edge of the sponge, hit the floor, and headed for the subway without waiting for his companion. Falstaff continued to climb slowly through the webbing.
"'Tis too much for a drinking man," he mumbled, as he crawled over another barrier.
The dragging metal sound abruptly stopped, and Falstaff's camera recorded an image of a long, skinny object with black and gold stripes. Moments later, the camera frame went to all black, and the little robot's terminal fault imminent alarm began to sound. Richard and Nicole had one more fleeting glimpse of a picture from Falstaff. It showed what might have been a giant eye from up close, a black, gelatinous mixture tinged with blue. Then all transmissions from the robot, including emergency telemetry, abruptly ceased. Meanwhile, Hal had entered the waiting subway. During the several seconds before the subway left the station, the ominous dragging sound was heard again. But the subway departed anyway, with the robot inside, and started speeding through the tunnel toward the two cosmonauts. Richard and Nicole breathed a sigh of relief. Not more than a second later, a loud sound like breaking glass was picked up by Prince Hal's audio system. Richard commanded the robot to turn in the direction of the sound, and Hal's camera photographed a solitary black and gold tentacle in mid-air. The tentacle had broken the window and was moving inexorably toward the robot. Both Richard and Nicole realized what was happening at the same moment. The thing was on top of the subway, and it was coming toward them. Nicole was climbing the spikes in a flash. Richard wasted several valuable seconds picking up his computer monitor and putting all his equipment in the backpack. He heard Prince Hal's terminal fault imminent alarm when he was halfway up the spikes. Richard turned around to look, just as the subway pulled into the tunnel below him. What he saw made his blood run cold. On top of the subway was a large, dark creature whose central body, if that was indeed what it was flattened against the roof. Striped tentacles extended in all directions. Four of them had pierced the windows of the train and grabbed the robot. The thing quickly climbed off the subway and wrapped one of its eight tentacles around the lowest spikes. Richard didn't watch any more. He clambered up the rest of the cylinder and started racing through the tunnel at the top, following the steps of Nicole far ahead of him in the distance. As he ran, Richard noticed that the tunnel was curving slightly to the right. He reminded himself that even though this was not the same tunnel they had used before, it should still lead them to the ramps. After several hundred meters, Richard stopped to listen for the sound of his pursuer. He heard nothing. Richard had just taken two deep breaths and started to run again when his ears were assaulted by a terrible wail in front of him. It was Nicole. Oh, shit, he thought, as he rushed forward to find her. Chapter 47 Progressive Matrices.
Never, never in my entire life,
Nicole said to Richard,
have I ever seen anything that terrified me like that.
The two cosmonauts were sitting with their backs against the bottom of one of the skyscrapers surrounding the Western Plaza. They were both still breathing heavily, exhausted from their frantic escape. Nicole took a long drink of water.
I had just started to relax, she continued. I could hear you behind me, and nothing else. I decided I would stop in the museum and wait for you to catch up. It hadn't yet occurred to me that we were in the other tunnel. It should have been obvious, of course, because the opening was on the wrong side, but I wasn't thinking logically at that moment. Anyway, I stepped inside the room, the lights came on, and there he was. Not more than 3 meters in front of me. I thought my heart had stopped altogether.
Richard remembered Nicole running into his arms in the tunnel and sobbing for several seconds.
It's Takagishi, stuffed like a deer or a tiger in the opening to the right, she had said in fits and starts.
After Nicole had regained her composure, the two of them had walked back down the tunnel together. Inside the opening, standing upright just opposite the entrance, Richard had been shocked to see Newton cosmonaut Shigeru Takagishi. He was dressed in his flight suit and looked exactly as he had the last time they had seen him at the Beta campsite. His face was fixed in a pleasant smile, and his arms were at his sides.
What the hell?
Richard had said, blinking twice. His curiosity only slightly stronger than his terror. Nicole had averted her eyes. Even though she had seen the sight before, the stuffed Takagishi was much too lifelike for her. They had only stayed in the large room for a minute. Alien taxidermy had also performed wonders on an avian with a broken wing that was hanging from the ceiling next to Takagishi. Against the wall behind the Japanese scientist was Richard and Nicole's hut that had disappeared the day before. The hexagonal electronics board from the Newton Portable Science Station was on the floor next to Takagishi's feet, not far from a full-scale model of a bulldozer biot. Other biot replicas were scattered around the room. Richard had started to study the varied collection of biots in the room, when they had faintly heard the familiar dragging noise coming from behind them in the tunnel. They had not wasted any more time. Their flight down the tunnel and up the ramps had been broken only by a brief stop at the cistern to replenish their supply of fresh water.
Dr. Takagishi was a gentle, sensitive man, Nicole was saying to Richard, with passionate feelings about his work. Just before launch, I visited him in Japan, and he told me that his lifelong ambition had been to explore a second Rama spacecraft. It's a shame he had to die such an unpleasant death,
Richard grimly replied.
I guess that Octo Spider, or one of its friends, must have dragged him down here for a visit to the taxidermist almost immediately. They certainly wasted no time putting him on display. You know, I don't think they killed him, Nicole said. maybe I'm hopelessly naive, but I didn't see any evidence of foul play in his statue.
You think they just scared him to death? Richard retorted sarcastically.
Yes, said Nicole firmly.
At least it's possible.
She spent the next 5 minutes explaining Takagishi's heart situation to Richard.
I'm surprised at you, Nicole,
Richard replied after listening carefully to her disclosure.
I had you figured all wrong.
I thought you were Miss Prim and Proper, player by the rules all the way. I never gave you credit for having a mind of your own, not to mention a strong streak of compassion.
In this instance, it's not clear that either was an asset. If I had faithfully enforced the rules, Takagishi would be alive and living with his family in Kyoto.
And he would have missed the singular experience of his life. Which brings me to an interesting question, my dear doctor. Surely you are aware, as we sit here, that the odds do not favor our escape. We are both likely to die without ever seeing another human face. How do you feel about that? Where does your death, or any death, for that matter, fit into your overall scheme of things?
Nicole looked at Richard. She was surprised by the tenor of his question. She tried without success to read the expression on his face.
I'm not afraid, if that's what you mean, she answered carefully. As a doctor, I've thought often about death. And of course, since my mother died when I was very young, even as a child I was forced to have some perspective on the subject.
She paused for a moment.
For myself, I know that I would like to stay alive until Genevieve is grown, so that I can be a grandmother to her children. But just being alive is not the most important thing. Life must have quality to be worthwhile. And to have quality, we must be willing to take a few risks. I'm not being very focused, am I?
Richard smiled.
No, he said. But I like your general drift. You have mentioned the key word. Quality.
Have you ever considered suicide? He asked suddenly.
No,
Nicole replied, shaking her head.
Never. There's always been too much to live for.
There must be some reason for his question, she was thinking.
What about you?
She said after a short silence.
Did you think about suicide during any of that pain with your father?
No, strangely enough, he answered. My father's beatings never made me lose my zest for life. There was too much to learn, and I knew that I would outgrow him and be on my own eventually.
There was a long pause before he continued.
But there was one period in my life when I did seriously consider suicide,
Richard said.
My pain and anger were so great that I did not think I could endure them.
He became silent, locked in his thoughts. Nicole waited patiently. Eventually, she slipped her arm through his.
Well, my friend, she said lightly, you can tell me about it some day. Neither of us is accustomed to sharing our deepest secrets. Maybe in time we can learn. I'm going to start by telling you why I believe we are not going to die, and why I think we should go over to search the area around the Eastern Plaza next.
Nicole had never told anyone, not even her father, about her trip during the Poro. Before she finished telling her story to Richard, not only had Nicole covered what had happened to her as a 7-year-old at the Poro, but also she had recounted the story of Omer's visit to Rome, the Sanufo prophecies about the woman without companion who scatters her progeny among the stars, and the details of her vision after drinking the vial at the bottom of the pit. Richard was speechless. The entire set of stories were so foreign to his mathematical mind that he did not even know how to react. He stared at Nicole with awe and amazement. At length, embarrassed by his silence, he started to speak.
I don't know what to say.
Nicole put her fingers to his lips.
You don't need to say anything, she said.
I can read your reaction in your face. We can talk about it tomorrow, after you've had some time to think about what I told you.
Nicole yawned and looked at her watch. She pulled her sleeping mat out of her backpack and unrolled it on the ground.
I'm exhausted, she said to Richard. Nothing like a little terror to produce instant fatigue. I'll see you in 4 hours.
We've been searching now for an hour and a half, Richard said impatiently. Look at this map. There's no place within 500 meters of the plaza center that we haven't been to at least twice.
Then we're doing something wrong, Nicole replied. There were 3 heat sources in my vision.
Richard frowned.
Or be logical if you prefer. Why would there be 3 plazas and only 2 underground layers? You said yourself that the Romans always followed a reasonable plan.
They were standing in front of a dodecahedron that faced the eastern plaza.
"And another thing," Richard growled to himself. "What's the purpose of all these damn polyhedrons? There's one in every sector, and the three biggest are in the plazas."
"Wait a minute," he said, as his eyes went from one of the 12 faces of the dodecahedron to an opposite skyscraper. His head then turned quickly around the plaza.
"Could it be?"
he said.
"No," he answered. "That would be impossible."
Richard saw that Nicole was staring at him.
"I have an idea,"
he said excitedly.
"It may be completely far-fetched. Do you remember Dr. Bartolini and his progressive matrices with the dolphins? What if the Ramans also left a pattern here in New York of subtle differences that change from plaza to plaza and section to section? Look, it's no crazier than your visions."
Already Richard was on his knees on the ground, working with his maps of New York.
"Can I use your computer too?" he said to Nicole a few minutes later. "That will speed up the process."
4 hours, Richard Wakefield sat beside the two computers, mumbling to himself and trying to solve the puzzle of New York. He explained to Nicole, when he took a break for dinner at her insistence, that the location of the third underground hole could only be determined if he thoroughly understood the geometric relationships between the polyhedrons, the three plazas, and all the skyscrapers immediately opposite the principal faces of the polyhedrons in each of the 9 sectors. 2 hours before dark, Richard dashed off hurriedly to an adjacent section to obtain extra data that had not yet been recorded on their computer maps. Even after dark, he did not rest. Nicole slept the first part of the 15-hour night. When she awoke after 5 hours, Richard was still working feverishly on his project. He didn't even hear Nicole clear her throat. She arose quietly and put her hands on his shoulders.
"You must get some sleep, Richard," she said quietly.
"I'm almost there," he said.
She saw the bags under his eyes when he turned around.
"No more than another hour."
Nicole returned to her mat. When Richard awakened her later, he was full of enthusiasm.
"Wouldn't you know it," he said with a grin. "There are 3 possible solutions, each of which is consistent with all the patterns."
He paced for almost a minute.
"Could we go look now?"
he then said pleadingly.
"I don't think I can sleep until I find out."
None of Richard's 3 solutions for the location of the third lair was close to the plaza. The nearest one was over a kilometer away, at the edge of New York, opposite the northern hemicylinder. He and Nicole found nothing there. Then they marched another 15 minutes in the dark to the second possible location, a spot very near the southeast corner of the city. Richard and Nicole walked down the indicated street and found the covering in the exact spot that Richard had predicted.
"Hallelujah!"
he shouted, spreading out his sleeping mat beside the cover.
"Hooray for mathematics!"
"Hooray for Omar," Nicole thought. She was no longer sleepy, but she wasn't anxious to explore any new territory in the dark. "What comes first?" she asked herself after they had returned to camp and she was lying awake on her mat. "Intuition or mathematics? Do we use models to help us find the truth? Or do we know the truth first and then develop the mathematics to explain it?" They were both up at daylight.
"The days are still growing slightly shorter," Richard mentioned to Nicole. "But the sum of daytime and nighttime is remaining constant at 46 hours, 4 minutes, and 14 seconds.
"How long before we reach the Earth?"
Nicole inquired, as she was stuffing her sleeping mat into its protective package.
20 Earth days and 3 hours, he replied after consulting his computer. "Are you ready for another adventure?"
She nodded.
"I presume you also know where to find the panel that opens this cover?"
"No, but I bet it's not hard to find," he said confidently. "And after we find this one, the avian layer opening will be duck soup, because we'll have the whole pattern."
10 minutes later, Richard pushed on a metal plate and the third covering swung open. The descent into this third hole was down a wide staircase, broken by occasional landings. Richard took Nicole's hand as they walked down the stairs. They used their flashlights to find their way, as no lights illuminated their descent. The water room was in the same place as in the other underground layers. There were no sounds in the horizontal tunnels that led off from the central stairway at either of the 2 main levels.
"I don't think anyone lives here," Richard said.
"At least not yet," Nicole answered.
Chapter 48. Welcome, Earthlings. Richard was puzzled. In the first room off one of the top horizontal tunnels, he had found an array of strange gadgets that he had decoded in less than an hour. He now knew how to regulate the lights and temperature throughout each particular portion of the underground lair. But if it was that easy, and all the lairs were similarly constructed, why did the avians not use the lights that had been provided? While they were eating breakfast, Richard quizzed Nicole about the details of the avian lair.
"You're overlooking more fundamental issues," Nicole said,
as she took a bite of manna melon.
"The avians aren't that important by themselves. The real question is, where are the Ramans? And why did they put these holes under New York in the first place?"
"Maybe they're all Ramans," Richard replied. "The biots, the avians, the octo-spiders. Maybe they all came originally from the same planet. At the beginning, they were all one happy family. But as the years and generations passed, different species evolved in different ways. Individual layers were constructed, and the—"
"There are too many problems with that scenario," Nicole interrupted. "First, the biots are definitely machines. The avians may or may not be. The octospiders almost certainly aren't, although a technological level that could create this spaceship in the first place might have progressed further in artificial intelligence than we could possibly imagine. My intuitive sense, however, says that those things are organic.
We humans would never be able to distinguish between a living creature and a versatile machine created by a truly advanced species."
"I agree with that. But we can't possibly resolve this argument by ourselves. Besides, there is another question that I want to discuss with you."
"What's that?" Richard asked.
"Did the avians and the octospiders and these underground regions exist also on Rama 1? If so, how did the Norton crew miss them altogether? If not, why are they on this spacecraft and not the first one?"
Richard was quiet for several seconds.
"I see where you're heading," he said finally. "The fundamental premise has always been that the Rama spacecraft were created millions of years ago by unknown beings from another region of the galaxy, and that they were totally uninvolved and disinterested in whatever they encountered during their trek. If they were created that long ago, why would two vehicles that were presumably built at virtually the same time have such striking differences?"
"I'm starting to believe that our colleague from Kyoto was right," Nicole answered. "Maybe there is a meaningful pattern to all this. I'm fairly confident that the Norton crew were thorough and accurate in its survey, and all the distinctions between Rama 1 and Rama 2 are indeed real. As soon as we acknowledge that the two spacecraft are different, we face a more difficult issue. Why are they different?"
Richard had finished eating and was now pacing in the dimly lit tunnel.
"There was a discussion just like this before it was decided to abort the mission. At the teleconference, the main question was, why did the Ramans change course to encounter the Earth? Since the first spacecraft had not done so, it was considered hard evidence that Rama 2 was different, and the people participating in that meeting knew nothing of the avians or octospiders."
"General Botsov would have loved the avians," Nicole commented after a short silence. "He thought that flying was the greatest pleasure in the world." She laughed. "He once told me that his secret hope in life was that reincarnation was on the level, and that he would come back as a bird."
"He was a fine man," Richard said, stopping his pacing momentarily. "I don't think we ever properly appreciated all his talents."
As Nicole replaced part of the manna melon in her backpack and prepared to continue the exploration, she smiled at her peripatetic friend.
"One more question, Richard," he nodded. "Do you think we've met any Ramans yet? By that I mean the creatures who made this vehicle, or any of their descendants."
Richard shook his head vigorously.
"Absolutely not," he said. "Maybe we've met some of their creations, or even other species from the same planet, but we haven't seen the main characters yet."
They found the White Room off to the left of a horizontal tunnel at the second level below the surface. Until then, the exploration had been almost boring. Richard and Nicole had walked down many tunnels and had peered into one empty room after another. Four times they had found a set of gadgets for regulating the lights and temperature. Until they reached the White Room, they had seen nothing else of interest. Both Richard and Nicole were astonished when they entered a room whose walls were painted a crisp white. In addition to the paint, the room was fascinating because one corner was cluttered with objects that turned out, on closer inspection, to be quite familiar. There was a comb and a brush, an empty lipstick container, several coins, a collection of keys, and even something that looked like an old walkie-talkie. In another pile, there was a ring and a wristwatch, a tube of toothpaste, a nail file, and a small keyboard with Latin letters. Richard and Nicole were stunned.
"Okay, genius," she said with a wave of her hand. "Explain all this if you can."
He picked up the tube of toothpaste, opened the cap, and squeezed. A white material came out. Richard put his finger in it, and then placed the finger in his mouth.
"Yuck,"
he said, spitting out the paste.
"Bring your mass spectrometer over here."
While Nicole was examining the toothpaste with her sophisticated medical instruments, Richard picked up each of the other objects. The watch in particular fascinated him. It was indeed keeping proper time, second by second, although its reference point was completely unknown.
"Did you ever go to the Space Museum in Florida?" he asked Nicole.
"No,"
she answered, distractedly.
"They had a display of the common objects taken by the crew on the first Rama mission.
This watch looks exactly like the one in the display. I remember it well because I bought a similar one in the museum shop."
Nicole walked over with a puzzled look on her face.
"This stuff isn't toothpaste, Richard. I don't know what it is. The spectra are astonishing,
with an abundance of super-heavy molecules."
For several minutes, the two cosmonauts rummaged in the odd collection of items, trying to make some sense out of their latest discovery.
"One thing is certain," Richard said, as he was trying unsuccessfully to open up the walkie-talkie. "These objects are definitely associated with human beings. There's simply too many of them for some kind of strange interspecies coincidence."
"But how did they get here?" Nicole asked.
She was trying to use the brush, but its bristles were far too soft for her hair. She examined it in more detail.
"This is not really a brush," she announced.
"It looks like a brush, and feels like a brush, but it's useless in the hair."
She bent down and picked up the nail file.
"And this can't be used to file any human's fingernails."
Richard came over to see what she was talking about. He was still struggling with the walkie-talkie. He dropped it in disgust and took the nail file that Nicole had extended toward him.
"So these things look human, but aren't," he said,
pulling the file against the end of his longest fingernail. The nail was unchanged. Richard gave the file back to Nicole.
"What's going on here?"
he shouted in a frustrated tone.
"I remember reading a science fiction novel when I was at the university," Nicole said a few seconds later, "in which an extraterrestrial species learned about human beings solely from our earliest television programs. When they finally met us, they offered cereal boxes and soaps and other objects the aliens had seen on our television commercials. The packages were all properly designed, but the contents were either non-existent or absolutely wrong."
Richard had not been listening carefully to Nicole. He had been fiddling with the keys and surveying the collection of objects in the room.
"Now what do all these things have in common?"
he said, mostly to himself. They both arrived at the same answer several seconds later.
"They were all carried by the Norton crew,"
Richard and Nicole said in unison.
"So the two Rama space vehicles must have some kind of communication link-up," Richard said.
"And these objects have been planted here on purpose to show us that the visit to Rama 1 was observed and recorded.
The spider biots that inspected the Norton campsites and the equipment must have contained imaging sensors.
And all of these things were fabricated from pictures transmitted from Rama 1 to Rama 2.
After Nicole's last comment, both of them were silent, each following their own thought pattern.
"But why do they want us to know all this?
What is it we're supposed to do now?"
Richard stood up and began to pace around the room. Suddenly, he started laughing.
"Wouldn't it be amazing," he said, "if David Brown was right after all?
If the Ramans really were completely disinterested in anything they found, but programmed their space vehicles to act interested in any visitors. They could flatter whatever species they encountered by making mid-course corrections and by fashioning simple objects. What an incredible irony. Since all immature species are probably hopelessly self-centered, the visitors to the Raman craft would be totally occupied trying to understand an assumed message."
"I think you're getting carried away," Nicole interrupted. "All we know at this point is that this spacecraft apparently received pictures from Rama 1, and that reproductions of small, everyday objects that were carried by the Norton crew have been placed here in this room for us to find."
"I wonder if the keyboard is as useless as everything else," Richard said as he picked it up.
He spelled the word Rama with the keys. Nothing happened. He tried Nicole. Still nothing. "Don't you remember how the old models worked?" Nicole said with a grin. She took the keyboard. "They all had a separate power key." She pressed the unmarked button in the upper right-hand corner of the keyboard. A portion of the opposite wall slid away, revealing a large black square area about 1 meter on a side. The small keyboard was based on one of the ones that had been attached to the portable computers on the first Rama mission. It had 4 rows of 12 characters, with an extra power button in the upper right-hand corner. The 26 Latin letters, 10 Arabic numerals, and 4 mathematical operands were marked on 40 of the individual keys. The other 8 keys contained either dots or geometrical figures on their surfaces, and in addition could be set in either an up or down position. Richard and Nicole quickly learnt that these special keys were the true controls of the Raman system. By trial and error, they also discovered that the result from striking any individual action key was a function of the positioning of the other 7 keys. Thus, pressing any specific command key could produce as many as 128 different results. Altogether, then, the system provided for 1,024 separate actions that could be initiated from the keyboard. Making a command dictionary was a laborious process. Richard volunteered for the duty. Using their own computers to keep notes, he began the process of developing the rudiments of a language to translate the special keyboard commands. The initial goal was simple: to be able to use the Raman computer like one of their own. Once the translation was developed, any given input into the Newton portable computers would contain, as part of its output, what set of key impressions on the Raman board would produce a similar response on the square black screen. Even with Richard's intelligence and computer expertise, the task was a formidable one. It was also not something that could easily be shared. At Richard's suggestion, Nicole climbed out of the lair twice during the first Raman day they were in the White Room. Both times she took long walks around New York, casting her eyes to the sky from time to time to look for a helicopter. On the second excursion, Nicole went back to the barn where she had fallen in the pit. Already, so much had happened that her frightening experience at the bottom seemed like ancient history. She thought often about Bortsov, Wilson, and Takagishi. All the cosmonauts had known, when they left the Earth, that there were uncertainties in the mission. They had trained often to handle vehicle emergencies, problems with their own spacecraft that might prove to be life-threatening. But none of them had actually believed that there would be any fatalities on the mission. "If Richard and I perish here in New York," Nicole remarked to herself, "then almost half the crew will have died. That will be the worst disaster since we started flying piloted missions again." She was standing outside the barn, in almost the exact spot where she and Francesca had talked to Richard on the communicator the last time. "So why did you lie, Francesca?" Nicole wondered. "Did you think somehow my disappearance would silence all suspicion?" On the final morning at the Beta campsite, before she and the others had set out to look for Takagishi, Nicole had transmitted all the notes in her own portable computer in Rama through the networking system to the desktop in her room on the Newton. At the time, Nicole had made the data transfer to give herself extra memory, if she should need it, in her traveling computer. "But it's all there," she recalled. "If some diligent detective ever looks for it. The drugs, David's blood pressure, even a cryptic reference to the abortion. And, of course, Richard's solution to the Rosser malfunction." On her 2 walks, Nicole saw several centipede biots, and even a bulldozer once, at the far limit of her vision. She didn't see any avians, and neither heard nor saw an octospider. "Maybe they only come out at night," she mused, as she returned to have dinner with Richard.
Chapter 49 Interaction.
"We're almost out of food," Nicole said. They packed up what remained of the manna melon and stuffed it in Richard's backpack.
"I know," he replied. "I have a plan for you to obtain some more."
"Me?" asked Nicole.
"Why is it my job?"
"Well, first of all, it only requires one person. Working with graphics on the Raman computer gave me the idea. Second, I can't spare the time. I think I'm on the verge of breaking into the operating system. There are about 200 commands that I can't explain unless they allow entry into another level, some kind of higher-order space in the hierarchy." Richard had explained to Nicole during dinner that he had now figured out how to use the Raman computer like one on the Earth. He could store and retrieve data,
perform mathematical computations, design graphics, even create new languages. But I haven't begun to tap its potential, he had said. Tonight and tomorrow I must discover more of its secrets. We're running out of time. His plan for obtaining food was, indeed, deceptively simple. After the long ramen night, during which Richard could not have slept more than 3 hours, Nicole walked over to the central plaza to implement the plan. Based on his progressive matrix analysis, Richard gave her 3 possible locations for the panel to open the covering above the avian layer. He was so confident of his analysis that he wouldn't even discuss what she should do if she didn't find the plate. Richard was correct. Nicole found the panel easily. Then she opened the cover and shouted down the vertical corridor. There was no response. She shone her flashlight into the darkness below her. The tank sentinel was on duty, going to and fro in front of the horizontal tunnel that led past the water room. Nicole shouted again. If she could avoid it, she did not want to descend even to the first ledge. Even though Richard had assured her he would come to her rescue if she was overdue, Nicole did not relish the prospect of being hemmed in with the avians again. Was that a distant jabbering she heard? Nicole thought so. She took one of the coins that she had found in the white room and dropped it into the vertical corridor. It sailed far down, hitting a ledge somewhere near the second main level. This time there was loud jabbering. One of the avians flew up into her flashlight beam and over the tank sentinel's head. Moments later, the cover began to close, and Nicole had to move away. She had discussed this contingency with Richard. Nicole waited several minutes and then pushed the panel again. When she yelled into the depths of the avian lair the second time, there was an immediate response. This time, her friend, the black velvet avian, flew up to within 5 meters of the surface and jabbered at her. It was clear to Nicole that she was being told to go away. Before the avian turned around, however, Nicole pulled out her computer monitor and activated a stored program. 2 mana melons appeared on the screen in graphic depiction. As the avian watched, the melons became colored, and then a neat incision displayed the texture and color inside one of them. The black velvet avian had flown up closer to the opening for a better look. Now it turned and screeched back into the dark below. Within seconds, a second familiar bird, the likely mate for the black velvet one, flew up and landed on the first ledge below the ground. Nicole repeated the display. The 2 birds talked and then flew deeper into the lair. Minutes went by. Nicole could hear occasional jabbering from the depths of the corridor. At length, her 2 friends returned, each carrying a small mana melon in its talons. They landed in the plaza near the opening. Nicole walked over toward the melons, but the avians continued to clutch them. What followed was, Nicole assumed, a long lecture. The 2 birds jabbered both individually and together, always looking at her and often tapping on the melons. 15 minutes later, apparently satisfied that they had communicated their message, the avians took flight, swooped around the plaza, and vanished into their lair. I think they were telling me that melons are in short supply, Nicole thought, as she walked back toward the eastern plaza. The melons were heavy. She had one in each of the 2 backpacks that she had emptied that morning before she left the white room. Or maybe that I should not disturb them in the future. Whatever it was, we will not be welcome any more. She thought that Richard would be ecstatic when she returned to the white room. He was, but not because of Nicole and the manor melons. He had a grin on his face from one ear to the other, and was holding one hand behind his back. "Wait until I show you what I have," he said as Nicole unloaded the backpacks. Richard brought his hand around in front of him and opened it. The hand contained a solitary black ball about 10 centimeters in diameter. "I'm nowhere near figuring out all the logic or how much information can go in the request," Richard said, "but I have established a fundamental principle. We can ask for and receive things using the computer."
"What do you mean?" Nicole asked,
still not certain why Richard was so excited about a small black ball.
"They made this for me," he said, handing her the ball again. "Don't you understand? Somewhere here they have a factory and can make things for us."
"Then maybe they, whoever they are, can start making us some food," said Nicole.
She was a little annoyed that Richard had neither congratulated her nor thanked her for the melons.
The avians are not likely to give us any more.
It will be no problem, Richard said. Eventually, once we learn the full range of the request process, we may be able to order fish and chips, steak and potatoes, anything, as long as we can state what we want in unambiguous scientific terms.
Nicole stared at her friend. With his unkempt hair, his unshaven face, the bags under his eyes, and his wild grin, he looked at the moment like a fugitive from an insane asylum.
Richard, she asked, will you slow down a little? If you found the Holy Grail, can you at least spend a second explaining it to me?
Look at the screen, he said. Using the keyboard, he drew a circle, then scratched it out and made a square. In less than a minute, Richard had carefully drawn a cube in three dimensions. When he was finished with the graphics, he put the 8 action keys into a predetermined configuration, and then pressed the key with the small rectangle designator. A set of strange symbols appeared on the black monitor.
Don't worry, Richard said. We don't need to understand the details. They are just asking for the dimensional specifications on the cube.
Richard next made a string of entries from the normal alphanumeric keys.
Now, he said, turning back to face Nicole, if I have done it correctly, we will have a cube, made from the same material as that ball, in about 10 minutes.
They ate some of the new melon while they waited. It tasted the same as the others. Steak and potatoes would be unbelievably good, Nicole was thinking, when suddenly the end wall lifted up 0.5 meter above the floor, and a black cube appeared in the gap.
Wait a minute, don't touch it yet,
Richard said, as Nicole went over to investigate.
Look here.
He shone his flashlight into the darkness behind the cube.
There are vast tunnels beyond these walls, he said, and they must lead to factories so advanced we couldn't even recognize them. Imagine! They can even make objects on request.
Nicole was beginning to understand why Richard was so ecstatic.
We now have the capability to control our own destiny in some small way, he continued. If I can break the code fast enough, we should be able to request food, maybe even what we need to build a boat.
Without loud motors, I hope, quipped Nicole.
No motors, agreed Richard. He finished his melon and turned back to the keyboard. Nicole was becoming worried. Richard had succeeded in only making one new breakthrough in a full Raman day. All he had to show for 38 hours of work, he had only slept 8 hours during the entire period, was one new material. He could make light black objects like the first ball, whose specific gravity was close to balsa wood, or he could make heavy black objects of density similar to oak or pine. He was wearing himself out with his work, and he could not or would not share any of the load with Nicole. What if his first discovery was just blind luck? Nicole said to herself as she climbed the stairs for her dawn walk. Or what if the system cannot make anything but 2 kinds of black objects? She could not help worrying about wasted time. It was only 16 more days until Rama would encounter the Earth. There was no sign of a rescue team. At the back of her mind was the thought that perhaps she and Richard had been abandoned altogether. She had tried to talk to Richard about their plans the previous evening, but he had been exhausted. Richard hadn't responded in any way when Nicole had mentioned to him that she was very concerned. Later, after she had carefully outlined all their options and asked his opinion about what they should do, she noticed that he had fallen asleep. When Nicole awakened after a brief nap herself, Richard was already working again at the keyboard and refused to be distracted by either breakfast or conversation. Nicole had stumbled over the growing array of black objects on the floor as she had exited the white room for her early morning exercise. Nicole was feeling very lonely. The last 50 hours, which she had spent mostly by herself, had passed very slowly. Her only escape had been the pleasure of reading. She had the text of 5 books stored in her computer. One was her medical encyclopedia, but the other 4 were all for recreation. I bet all of Richard's discretionary memory is filled with Shakespeare, she thought, as she sat on the wall surrounding New York. She stared out at the cylindrical sea. In the far distance, barely visible in her binoculars, through the mist and clouds, she could see the northern bowl where they had entered Rama the first time. She had 2 of her father's novels stored in the computer. Nicole's personal favorite was Queen for All Ages, the story of Eleanor of Aquitaine's younger years, beginning with her adolescence at the ducal court in Poitiers. The storyline followed Eleanor through her marriage to Louis Capet of France, their crusade to the Holy Land, and her extraordinary personal appeal for an annulment from Pope Eugenius. The novel culminated with Eleanor's divorce from Louis and betrothal to the young and exciting Henry Plantagenet. The other Pierre de Jardin novel in her computer's memory was his universally acclaimed chef d'œuvre, I, Richard Coeur de Lion, a mixture of first-person diary and interior monologue, set during two winter weeks at the end of the 12th century. In the novel, Richard and his soldiers, embarked on another crusade, are quartered near Messina under the protection of the Norman King of Sicily. While there, the famous warrior king and homosexual son of Eleanor of Aquitaine and Henry Plantagenet, in a burst of self-examination, relives the major personal and historical events of his life. Nicole remembered a long discussion with Genevieve after her daughter had read I, Richard the previous summer. The young teenager had been fascinated by the story, and had surprised her mother by asking extremely intelligent questions. Thoughts of Genevieve made Nicole wonder what her daughter might be doing at Beauvoir at the very moment. "They have told you that I have disappeared," Nicole surmised. "What does the military call it? Missing in action?" In her mind's eye, Nicole could see her daughter riding home from school each day on her bicycle. "Any news?" Genevieve would probably say to her grandfather, as she crossed the portal of the villa. Pierre would just shake his head, sorrowfully. "It has been 2 weeks now since anyone has officially seen me. Do you still have hope, my darling daughter?" The bereft Nicole was struck by an overwhelming desire to talk to Genevieve. For a moment, suspending reality, Nicole could not accept the fact that she was separated from her daughter by millions of kilometers and had no way to communicate with her. She rose to return to the white room, thinking in her temporary confusion that she could phone Genevieve from there. When her sanity returned several seconds later, Nicole was astonished at how easily her mind had tricked itself. She shook her head and sat down on the wall overlooking the cylindrical sea. She remained on the wall for almost 2 hours, her thoughts roaming freely over a variety of subjects. Toward the end of the time, when she was preparing to return to the White Room, her mind focused on Richard Wakefield. "I have tried, my British friend," Nicole said to herself. "I have been more open with you than with anyone since Henry. But it would be just my luck to be here with someone even less trusting than myself." Nicole was feeling an undefined sadness as she trekked down the stairs to the second level and turned right at the horizontal tunnel. Her sadness changed to surprise when she entered the white room. Richard jumped up from his small black chair and greeted her with a hug. He had shaved and brushed his hair. He had even cleaned his fingernails. Laid out on the black table in the middle of the room was a neatly sectioned manor melon. One piece sat on each of the two black plates in front of the chairs. Richard pulled out her chair and indicated for Nicole to sit down. He went around the table and sat at his own seat. He reached across the table and took both of Nicole's hands. "I want to apologize," he said with great intensity, "for being such a bore. I have behaved very badly these last few days. I've thought of thousands of things to tell you during these hours I've been waiting," he continued hesitantly, a strained smile playing across his lips. "But I can't remember most of them. I know I wanted to explain to you how very important Prince Hal and Falstaff were to me. They were my closest friends. It has not been easy for me to deal with their deaths. My grief is still very intense." Richard took a drink of water and swallowed. "But most of all," he said, "I'm sorry that I have not told you what a spectacular person you are. You are intelligent, attractive, witty, sensitive, everything I ever dreamed of finding in a woman. Despite our situation, I've been afraid to tell you how I felt. I guess my fear of rejection runs very deep." Tears welled out of the corner of Richard's eyes and ran down his cheeks. He was trembling slightly. Nicole could tell what an incredible effort it had been for him. She brought his hands up against her cheeks. "I think you're very special, too," she said. Chapter 50 Hope Springs Eternal. Richard continued to work with the Rama computer, but he limited himself to short sessions and involved Nicole whenever he could. They took walks together and chatted like old friends. Richard entertained Nicole by acting out entire scenes from Shakespeare. The man had a prodigious memory. He tried to play both sides in the love scenes from Romeo and Juliet, but every time he broke into his falsetto, Nicole would erupt with laughter. One night, they talked for over an hour about Omer, the Sanufo tribe, and Nicole's visions. "You understand that it's difficult for me to accept the physical reality of some of these stories," Richard said, attempting to qualify his curiosity. "Nevertheless, I admit that I find them absolutely fascinating." Later, he showed keen interest in analyzing all the symbolism in her visions. It was obvious that he acknowledged Nicole's mystical attributes as just another component in her rich personality. They slept nuzzling together before they made love. When they did finally have intercourse, it was gentle and unhurried, surprising both of them with its ease and satisfaction. A few nights later, Nicole was lying with her head on Richard's chest, quietly drifting in and out of sleep. He was in deep thought. "Several days ago," he said, nudging her awake, "back before we became so intimate, I told you that I considered committing suicide once. At the time, I was afraid to tell you the story. Would you like to hear it now?" Nicole opened her eyes. She rolled over and put her chin on his stomach. "Uh-huh," she said. She reached up and kissed him on the eyes before he began his tale. "I guess you know I was married to Sarah Tidings when both of us were very young," he began. "It was also before she was famous. She was in her first year with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and they were performing Romeo and Juliet, As You Like It, and Cymbeline in repertory at Stratford. Sarah was Rosalind and Juliet, and fantastic at both. She was 18 at the time, just out of school. I fell in love with her the first night I saw her as Juliet. I sent her roses in the dressing room every evening, and used most of my savings to see all the performances. We had two long dinners together, and then I proposed. She accepted more from astonishment than love. I went to graduate school at Cambridge after the summer was over. We lived in a modest flat, and she commuted to the theatre in London. I would go with her whenever I could, but after several months my studies demanded more of my time." Richard stopped his narrative and glanced down at Nicole. She had not moved. She was lying partially across him, a smile of love on her face. "Go on," she said softly. "Sarah was an adrenaline junkie. She craved excitement and variety. The mundane and tedious angered her. Grocery shopping, for example, was a colossal bore. It was just too much trouble for her to turn on the set and decide what to order. She also found any kind of schedule incredibly constraining. Lovemaking had to be performed in a different position or be accompanied by some different music every time. Otherwise it was old hat. For a while I was creative enough to satisfy her. I also took care of all the routine tasks to free her from the drudgery of housework. But there were only so many hours in the day. Ultimately, despite my considerable abilities, my graduate studies began to suffer because I was spending all my energy making life interesting for her. After we had been married for a year, Sarah wanted to rent a flat in London so that she didn't need to make the long commute every night after a performance. Actually, she had already been spending a couple of nights a week in London, ostensibly with one of her actress friends. But her career was soaring, and we had plenty of money, so why should I say no? It was not long before rumors about her behavior became quite widespread. I chose to ignore them, fearing, I guess, that she wouldn't deny them if I asked her. Then, one night, late, while I was studying for an examination, I received a phone call from a woman. She was very polite, although obviously distraught. She told me that she was the wife of the actor Hugh Sinclair, and that Mr. Sinclair, who at that time was starring with Sarah in the American drama In Any Weather, was having an affair with my wife. "In fact," she told me, "he is over at your wife's flat at this very moment." Mrs. Sinclair started crying, and then hung up. Nicole reached up and softly caressed Richard's cheek with her hand. "I felt as if my chest had exploded," he said, remembering the pain. "I was angry, terrified, frantic. I went to the station and took the late train to London. When the taxi dropped me at Sarah's place, I ran to the door. I did not knock. I bolted up the stairs and found the two of them sleeping naked in the bed. I picked Sarah up and flung her against the wall. I can still remember the sound of her head smashing into the mirror. Then I fell on him in a rage, punching his face over and over until it was nothing but a mass of blood.
It was awful.
Richard stopped himself and began to cry, noiselessly. Nicole put her arms around his heaving chest and wept with him.
"Darling, darling," she said.
"I was an animal," he cried. "I was worse than my father ever was. I would have killed them both if the people in the next flat hadn't restrained me."
Neither of them said anything for several minutes. When Richard spoke again, his voice was subdued, almost remote.
"The next day, after the police station and the tabloid reporters and all the recriminations with Sarah, I wanted to kill myself. I would have done it, too, if I had owned a gun. I was considering the gruesome alternatives, pills, slitting my wrists with a razor blade, jumping off a bridge, when another student called to ask me a detailed question on relativity. There was no way, after 15 minutes of thinking about Mr. Einstein, that suicide was still a viable option. Divorce? Certainly. Celibacy? Highly likely. But death was out of the question. I could never have prematurely terminated my love affair with physics."
His voice trailed off. Nicole wiped her eyes and placed her hands in his. She leaned her naked body across Richard's and kissed him.
"I love you," she said.
Nicole's sounding alarm indicated that it was daylight again in Rama. 10 more days, she noted after a quick mental calculation. "We'd better have a serious talk now." The alarm had awakened Richard as well. He turned and smiled at his sleeping partner.
"Darling," Nicole said, "the time has come.
Luora said to speak of many things.
Come on now, be serious. We have to decide what we're going to do. It's fairly obvious that we're not going to be rescued."
"I agree," said Richard.
He sat up and reached across Nicole's mat for his shirt.
"I have been dreading this moment for days, but I guess we have finally reached the point where we should consider swimming across."
"You don't think there's any chance of making a boat out of our black stuff?"
"No," he answered. "One material is too light, and the other too heavy. We could probably build a hybrid that would be seaworthy if we had some nails, but without any sails we would still have to row across. Our best bet is to swim."
Richard stood up and walked over to the black square on the wall.
"My fancy plans didn't pan out, did they?"
He thumped lightly on the square.
"And I was going to produce steak and potatoes as well as a boat."
"The best laid plans of mice and men. Gang aft aglay."
What a weird poet old Brubby was. I never could understand what people saw in him.
Nicole finished dressing and started doing some stretching exercises.
"Phew," she said, "I'm out of shape. I haven't had any heavy physical activity in days."
She smiled at Richard, who was looking at her coyly.
"That doesn't count," she added, shaking her head. "It's almost the only exercise I've ever liked," Richard replied with a grin. "I used to hate it at the academy when we had those special physical training weekends."
Richard had laid out small portions of manna melon on the black table.
3 more meals after this one," he said without emotion. "I guess we swim before it's dark again."
"You don't want to go this morning?" Nicole asked.
"No,"
he replied.
"Why don't you go survey the coast and pick a spot? I found something last night on the computer that has me baffled. It won't give us food or sailboats, but it looks as if I may have finally broken through into another kind of structure."
After breakfast, Nicole kissed Richard goodbye and wandered up to the surface. It did not take her long to reconnoiter the coast. There really were no reasons to pick one embarkation point over another. The grim reality of the coming swim oppressed Nicole.
"The odds are good," she told herself, "that neither Richard nor I will be alive when it is dark again in Rama."
She tried to imagine what it would be like to be eaten by a shark biot. Would it be a quick death? Or would you drown, aware that your legs had just been amputated? Nicole shuddered at the idea.
"Maybe we should try to obtain another melon."
She knew that was useless. Sooner or later, they had to swim. Nicole turned her back on the sea. "At least these last few days have been good," she said to herself, not wanting to think any more about their predicament. He had been an excellent companion, in every way. She allowed herself the momentary luxury of recalling their shared pleasure. Then Nicole smiled and started walking back toward the lair.
"But what am I looking at?"
Nicole asked, as another image flashed up on the black square.
"I'm not completely certain,"
Richard replied. All I know is that I have tapped into a long list of some kind. You remember that one particular command configuration that produces the lines of symbols that look like Sanskrit? Well, I was scrolling through the gibberish, and eventually I noticed a pattern. I stopped at the beginning of the pattern, changed the position of the last three keys, and then hit the double dot again. Suddenly, an image was on the screen. And every time I hit an alphanumeric, the picture changed.
But how do you know you're looking at sensor output?
Richard entered a command, and there was a change in the image. Occasionally I see something I recognize, he said. Look at that one, for example. Couldn't that be the beta stairway, viewed from a camera in the middle of the central plane? Nicole studied the picture.
Possibly, she said. But I don't see how you could ever tell for certain.
Richard commanded the screen to change again. The next three pictures were unintelligible. The fourth one showed a feature tapering to a point at the top of the frame. And that one, he said. Couldn't it be one of the little horns, as seen from a sensor near the top of the big horn? No matter how hard she tried, Nicole could not visualize what the view would be like from the top of the giant spire in the center of the southern bowl. Richard continued to flip through the pictures. Only about one in five was even partially clear.
Somewhere in this system there must be some enhancement algorithms, he said to himself. Then I can sharpen up all the images.
Nicole could tell that Richard was about to begin another long work session. She walked over to him and put her arms around his neck.